Welcome to episode 2 of Conversations on Transformation, recorded live at the 2023 Conference on Structural Transformation, Growth and Economic Development. My name is Tim Phillips. Gary Becker famously said that the best industrial policy is no policy at all, but it seems that the policy makers weren't listening. Whatever you think of industrial policy, you cannot deny that there is a lot of it about these days. But exactly how much, which countries are using it, and what for? At the conference, Nathan Lane from the University of Oxford presented his innovative research that uses machine learning to find answers to these questions. Nathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that does sound like Gary Becker.
Yeah.
How did the presentation go?
It was lively.
Lively?
In a good way.
That means a lot of questions.
Yes, which is what I like. There's nothing more terrifying than a silent room. I like when economists are pushing you, giving that kind of real-time economist feedback, which is sometimes pretty harsh. But we're at the point where we're not getting completely flanked by questions and issues people are bringing up. And so we're able to answer these things, and we're kind of confident in our work. And that's the nice thing about coming out of a lively presentation is it's if you are able to answer everything appropriately, and we are.
This is not your average economics paper. Your methodology is different. The question that you're asking is such a broad question. Well, let's ask you some more questions.
Yes.
You're
yes,
used to it by now yeah. this morning. So first of all, industrial policy. I mean, I always think of industrial policy as the Soviet Union, you know, making a city so that they can make more steel.
Yes.
What is industrial policy in 2023?
Our definition of industrial policy is essentially it's intentional state action that's meant to change the composition, intentionally change the composition of economic activity within an economy. So that can be done in a lot of ways. Like the Soviet Union under Stalin was surely doing it, was surely doing something like industrial policy. But states intervene in all sorts of ways in the contemporary world that, of course, look not anything like Soviet planning or command type economies of the past. In fact, all during the Cold War, non-communist countries were doing industrial policy because many countries have the demand from their constituents and for various reasons want to shape what's done in an economy. There's demand for military production. There's demand for certain types of technologies that they want to invest in. There's all these sorts of things. And so they intervene quite often. And the industrial policy of today looks unlike the industrial policy of the past. It looks a lot like export promotion, not overt protectionism, but you see a lot of export promotion, subsidies, various grant subsidies that are tied to economic activity and performance. You see things like FDI. You don't see as much in our data, at least in the kind of developed world. You don't see a lot of the tariffs and that type of stuff going on. Yeah.
But the jumping off point from your paper, and this I quote from your paper, we lack both measures and comprehensive data on industrial policy, which is why your paper is called The Who, What, When, and How of Industrial Policy. Yes. You've mentioned all these tools, all these methods. There's data on all of those. Can't you just count them all up and then you have some kind of indicator of industrial policy?
There are issues with that. Like, let's take a data set of tariffs. There's great data sets of international tariffs. We work with them. You can grab a tariff and you can look at the relationship between economic growth in a sector and the tariff level in that sector. What that tariff is telling you about industrial policy can be a little tricky to ascertain because a tariff can be used to raise revenue. It can be used for all sorts of balance of trade issues. It can be used for an amalgam of reasons that aren't just industrial policy. So thus, when we take data off the shelf and start using it and inferring things about the efficacy of industrial policy from those measures, well, is it industrial policy or not? That's kind of the question.
And that is a question that you have decided to answer using machine learning.
Yes.
And you're doing that with textual analysis, analyzing policy descriptions to see if they meet this definition of industrial policy that you gave to me. So first of all, where are these descriptions? How much text are we talking about?
Yeah. So if we zoom out, like political actors always talk about policies. They talk about policies using natural language. They talk about the intentions of policies. And so it occurred to us that the intentions of policies matter. And policy descriptions, well, they're all over the place, but in a coherent, consistent, comprehensive way, they're collected by this amazing outfit. I want to really emphasize they're amazing. The Global Trade Alerts database, folks in Switzerland, who try to cover essentially the extent of global commercial policy around the world. And they record all sorts of things about policy announcements being made. And by the way, they try to focus on any policy that affects and discriminates against foreign entities in global commerce. And they collect what we call metadata, the sectors affected, whether firms are affected, the data announcements made. But they also collect, importantly for us, they collect and summarize these policies. They collect textual data. And that textual data is what we use because, like I said, it's amazing how overt and expressive policymakers are in describing what policies do, what their intentions of policies are. And for us, those intentions are key things to measure and pick up.
So to be able to extract meaning from this massive database, you have to train your model. The machine has to learn what industrial policy looks like on the page. How do you train that model?
It's a multi-step process. So we have a workflow for doing this. And what we do is, first off, I just want to say, we come up with a very tight definition and code book of what industrial policy is. We don't come up with it. It actually is an amalgamation, a synthesis of what other people, legal entities, the US government, the OECD, how they define industrial policy. Mm-hmm. We put that in a succinct way. We put that in a code book. And what we do is we go to that data set, that global trade alerts data set. We take a subsample of it. And my poor students, our poor students, RECA students too, who took our development policy courses, who won an RA position, a research assistant position, we train them and hire them as RAs to code and classify, is this text industrial policy? Is it not? Using our code book. And we run a bunch of diagnostic tests to see if they've, you know, classified things coherently and kind of do due diligence. And we use that training data set to train our model. And we fit a model that's able to understand what is the mapping between the text in industrial policy and whether it's industrial policy or not. And so that's what we're getting at. And we're able to fit a model that maps text to an indicator of whether it's industrial policy or not. And the baseline thing we do is we fit a logistic regression that's able to find that mapping, that's able to make that mapping between our text and a prediction, whether you're industrial policy or not, on that training data set, on that annotated data set.
Yeah, for people who are not familiar with these machine learning methods, it is remarkable what you do. But of course, the model's always going to come out with some answer, and it's not necessarily a coherent answer.
Absolutely.
How confident were you that you were going to come out with something coherent? And when you checked, how do you check to make sure that it is what you intend?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's a couple ways in which coherence can go wrong. Like the first is, like, are people even agreeing on what industrial policy is? Does our code book make sense to the people who are coding stuff? And so there, what we do is we look for agreement. For example, let's say we have four research assistants code a policy, industrial policy or not, by reading the text. And we're going to make sure they have relative agreement on that policy. We're going to use a majority rule voting. And we check the consistency and agreement amongst annotators. So what we do to make sure our model is performing well, we do something very standard, K-fold cross-validation. You think of our annotated data set, the things that all our RAs have coded up. Within that annotated data set, it's about 7% of the observations in that big database. We iterate over it a bunch of times, and we're seeing whether the model is correctly predicting things within that data set. Meaning, we're going to hold out a little bit of that annotated data set, fit the model on a subsample of that annotated data set, and see how it performs on the data for which we know what the true prediction should be. And we do that over and over and over again, and we see how it performs. And it performs relatively well.
What are we saying when you say it performs relatively well? Because a lot of economists are going to be uncomfortable with that sort of language.
Absolutely. So because we're iterating over this, you can get a sense as to its performance. And there's a couple metrics you can use to assess the performance of an algorithm as you're doing this cross-validation.
Yeah.
And so you can use the measure appropriately called accuracy. You can use precision. You can use more wonky one, F1 score. And just think of all these things as reflecting how good are the predictions? How good are the predictions of this model on this testing procedure you're doing? Mm-hmm. How good are the predictions that are emerging from it? And is it overfitting? Is it doing other wacky stuff? And so accuracy is about 93, 94% accurate on that, you know, by doing this procedure. It's pretty darn accurate at predicting things.
And you can continue to improve it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is the most baseline model. Like if we take a step back, what we did is we fit a logistic regression. This is a tool all economists, we all learn it in econometrics. We all know what a logistic regression is. We know it's a pretty simple model. It creates a very simple mapping between text and our industrial policy prediction. We can do a whole bunch of other more complex models to make that mapping. Mm-hmm. We can use something called a neural net. We can do deep learning. We can do all sorts of things that give us that link that can allow us to go from that policy description text to a prediction. And there's amalgam ways we can go there in much more sophisticated ways. They're much more sophisticated than our near and dear tool, the kind of logistic regression. And so we can improve it incrementally by using more sophisticated tools, more sophisticated, what we call classifiers. You can represent text in more sophisticated ways. I abstracted away from how we represent text as numbers. There's a whole bunch of ways you can improve upon that. So that 93% is the baseline score for our crudest, most simple model. 93% is great for that logistic regression. That's like a near and dear to our economist's heart, which is a relatively simple tool.
If you want to know more about STEG, its funding, its research agenda, or its future events, then visit steg.cepr.org. That's STEG, spelled S-T-E-G, .cepr.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Given your basic model, which doesn't sound very basic, but I understand what you're saying, what can we learn from this? Is there as much industrial policy as there used to be?
Well, I should say we go from in this data set that we're analyzing, because we fit this model, we fit it on that training data, we take it to the whole data set, about 30,000 observations, and we start counting up the extent of industrial policy. That model can predict industrial policy or not. We run it across that whole database, and we're able to build measures of industrial policy using that classifier at the sector, year, country level. And so what we're able to do is create some quantitative measures, some very crude ones. These are only counts, portions. What we're able to say, even with these relatively simple measures, is that industrial policy is pretty prominent just across this whole data set. About 27% of the observations in this data set from 2008 to 2020 are industrial policy. And this is a data set covering all commercial policy that's affecting foreign economic actors in some way. And so it's quite substantial. And you do see, indeed, it's been trending upward through time. Since 2008 through 2020, it's indeed trending up. And that's a hunch we have, that industrial policy has probably returned. It's reemerged as something governments do more and more since 2008. That's kind of our smell test. Do we see that pattern that we all believe it should be there?
Is this industrial policy, is it applied to entire sectors? So like some country wants to become good at something or other, or is it applied to particularly good firms?
Both. Industrial policy can be applied to a type of activity, decarbonizing a type of economic activity, be applied to something like exporting. But indeed, it's often applied to sectors. And we find very often in this data set, it's applied to individual firms.
Huh.
Yeah. And sometimes there's good reason for that. You might have a giant monopoly. You might have entire sectors, steel, that are dominated by a couple giant firms or one giant state-owned firm, something like that. So that's something we found that surprised us. But when you think about it, it's like, okay, you know, there is some kind of rationale for that.
When you are applying it to individual firms, I guess that changes the sorts of tools that you use to implement industrial policy.
It surely does. You could think of, there can be much more specificity and probably bureaucratic control over a single firm than 100 firms in the textile sector, something like that. So what we find in our data set too, what we find in our measures and in our data, in our descriptive evaluations of the world, is industrial policy seems to be much more technocratic, much more kind of bureaucratically intense stuff is going on than we previously thought. It's not just people raising taxes and duties at a port. It's people doing these export loans that are complicated instruments or doing sophisticated subsidies, these types of things. I would imagine that it's easier to do that with an individual firm than a giant sector that's dominated by a multitude of very small firms and very small actors. So it's
When people criticize industrial policy, they often talk about how wrong it is for the government to pick winners.
Yes.
There seems to be a little bit in your data that says the government is recognizing winners and making things better for them.
We can't quite say that. We wish we could say something more definitive about what the performance, what the efficacy of these policies are. So in our data set, what we measure is something called reveal comparative advantage. Let's say how good a country is at exporting a certain product. What we find is that countries, especially wealthy countries, high-income countries, tend to target things they're pretty darn good at. We see that correlation. Whether that correlation exists because they grew by virtue of industrial policy or not, that's kind of an open question. That's what we don't want to do next. But we see this correlation here. Or maybe it could be, a critic could say, well, maybe they're just throwing money at things for which they're already good at. Maybe that investment would have already taken place. So that's what a critic might say. So we do find this correlation between the use of policy in wealthy countries and it being targeted towards stuff countries are relatively good at. And to go back to your question too, before, you can imagine that picking winners might be relatively easy. And this ties back to a literature in economics and international trade called granularity. Mm-hmm. There might be single firms that dominate the whole world market. And so as a government, well, there's probably good reason for you to maybe meddle in that sector. It represents probably a large proportion of your comparative advantage on the world market. Individual firms are probably much easier to target. They're probably much easier to pick winners with respect to sometimes. That's just a hunch. If I think about the theoretical and empirical literature in that pocket of economics right now.
The way we're talking about industrial policy, it's a million miles away from that stereotype with which I started of a command economy.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at the sorts of legislation that are coming in, we could describe as industrial policy, the Inflation Reduction Act in the US
yes.
and the EU response to it.
Absolutely.
These are being done by democratic governments. Industrial policy no longer a tool of the command economy autocrat?
No, absolutely not. And people have that characterization of industrial policy as a tool of autocracies or a tool of non-democracies. Mm. And in the data, it's clear, like, no, the liberal democracies indeed use industrial policy. And they use them in parallel with the Soviet Union. Some countries that developed particular expertise in deploying industrial policy were radically anti-communist. I mean, South Korea was by no means a communist, or France. You know, these were liberal democracies developing the tools to do industrial policy. And you see that reflected today. I think it's unhelpful to characterize industrial policy as Soviet style. You're trying to centrally plan a whole economy. Countries are using markets. They're using market forces. They're using price signals. And they're trying to intervene where markets probably can't do things, where there's market failures, where there's externalities and things like that. So it's a much different diagnostic technique. There's much different economic demands that they're accommodating relative to, you know, someone trying to plan the Soviet economy with Gauss plan.
Hey, Nathan, one thing we haven't discussed, we're at the STEG conference, Structural Transformation and Economic Growth. Again, industrial policy is traditionally a tool of development
so that low-income
countries could grow faster. We've been discussing mostly high-income country type tools and policies so far. Is now industrial policy really something that's done in rich countries?
So what we can say in our data set and what we observe is a lot of industrial policy being done by high-income countries. I think industrial policy in the ways that we're exploring it in this paper are often very bureaucratically and administratively intensive, and they're being done by wealthy countries. So if you're a small country, a small open economy with, let's say, weak state capacity, weak bureaucratic capacity, and you're competing against a monolith, a juggernaut on the world market, who might have comparative advantage in a good you do not have comparative advantage in, it might be very tricky for you to deploy industrial policy. So that's a sobering look at industrial policy. Of course, there's bias in this data set. There might be bias towards measuring commercial policies more in the developed world. There's more newspapers, there's more ears to the ground. But I think there's a reason, there's an amalgam of reasons why we don't see industrial policy pursued in the developing world. I think one aspect of that is it's probably, in the forms we're talking about today, probably extremely hard to do. It takes a lot. It takes a lot of administrative capacity, which governments might not have.
So any policymaker who's listening to this, and they do, Nathan, any policymaker who's listening to this is going to say, when is he going to tell me which industrial policy works best? Can you do that yet?
Yes, we can't. We can't. I wish we could. There's all sorts of methodological issues with doing that. But first and foremost, we needed measures to actually make these types of comparative studies, to make those types of comparative inquiries. Well, what's the relationship between this policy lever and growth? In order to do that, we needed some measures like this. We probably even need deeper measures than what we have now. But more specifically, no one's really nailed down that relationship yet. Because first and foremost, we don't have data. But also there's methodological issues backing out what's the causal effect of industrial policy on industrialization or growth. We do have some well-identified studies that show it in very specific cases. My previous work on South Korea, we look at South Korea and showed, well, maybe there were some instances where industrial policy did some stuff right in one particular episode, but saying something more general and saying something more comparative, we're not there yet, which is exciting for us because we want to use these measures. We want to use this type of analysis to make that type of assessment, to do those types of policy evaluations, to decompose what might work in one context, what might work in the other. We can also think about when industrial policy might not always work in some contexts. Some industrial policies might work better for countries with certain institutional arrangements. Others might work in countries with much different institutional arrangements. But to get to that interaction between the efficacy of industrial policy and its interaction with institutions, we need comparative work. We need comparative measures too. We need to have a data set. We need data that allows us to start kind of mining the world for those types of relationships. And we're only starting to have that data. And this data is just one rough cut into showing, well, here's one way that we can produce that data to start asking those pretty pressing questions.
This is very exciting. It's not just what you've been able to find out so far, but the way in which you're approaching the question. As you say, there's plenty more that we can find out. So,
Yeah.
I'm sure that we'll be having this conversation again in the future. But Nathan, for now, thank you very much.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
The paper is called The Who, What, When and How of Industrial Policy, a Text-Based Approach. And the authors are Reka Juhasz, Nathan Lane, Emery Olsen and Veronica Perez. You have been listening to Conversations on Transformation, recorded live at the STEG Annual Conference 2023. STEG stands for Structural Transformation and Economic Growth, and the conference was held in collaboration with the Center for Economic Policy Research and the International Growth Center.